Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What role do witnesses play in solving crimes and bringing perpetrators to justice? And can their accounts always be trusted? Historically, eyewitness identifications have sometimes resulted in convictions even in the absence of corroborating physical evidence. But as my guest discovered, these identifications can be wrong even when witnesses believe they're telling the truth, with devastating consequences for people then tried for crimes they did not commit. Filmmaker Joe Berlinger is host of the documentary series The System on Al Jazeera America. The episode Eyewitness Identification airs June 8th. Joe, welcome to Think.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. So in this series, you take on a number of issues in the justice system that should concern all of us, from false confessions to the problems with mandatory sentencing. Can you talk about how you chose the topics that you would focus on here?
Yeah, you know, I did a series of films called the Paradise Lost series, or Paradise Lost Trilogy. Actually, it started out as one film, and then it became three because the subjects didn't get out of prison after the first film, and I thought they should have. And in doing this Paradise Lost film, it just became clear to me that, you know, our justice system is imperfect, and people often find themselves wrongfully convicted. And so when Al Jazeera asked me to do, you know, a series on this subject, I wanted to pick areas that are problematic, you know, areas that lead to wrongful convictions. And so that was kind of the window that we looked at everything through. So we did an episode on flawed forensics. You know, sometimes the science goes awfully wrong, as in the case of the episode we did where the FBI crime lab actually bungled over 21,000 cases and took, you know, over a decade for this to be revealed. We also look at the phenomenon of false confessions. It's counterintuitive, you know, for people to think, well, why would somebody falsely confess to a crime? But it happens in a shocking number of cases. In fact, almost 30% of the DNA exonerations to date have shown that those cases also had a false confession. And then something that we focused on involving a Dallas case is the idea of faulty eyewitness identifications. That is, again, you would think that an eyewitness identification is rock solid, but as we see in a good number of these cases, there are certain techniques and tactics that are used that skew the results, and eyewitness identifications are not as rock solid as they should be, and lead to wrongful convictions. So we did 8 episodes, and we just looked at various issues that lead to wrongful convictions.
Did you come away with the sense that all of these things can happen? Certainly there are bad actors out there within the criminal justice system, just as there are bad actors in, you know, retail and media and everywhere else. But I think what's surprising, what may surprise a lot of people, is that it's not necessarily a case of people getting together and wanting to do these things wrong, but a little bit of carelessness can really wreak havoc.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, you know, I have tremendous respect for law enforcement and tremendous respect for prosecutors. It's neither of those jobs are easy, and I think the vast majority of people in both of these positions, you know, honor the badge, honor the oath they took, and try to do the right thing. The problem is that the system is run by human beings, and human beings make mistakes. You know, that's not to give everybody an out. We have seen situations where there is purposeful police misconduct.
Yeah.
You know, there's a case in New York City, Detective Scarsella, where over 50 cases are in review because of, you know, tactics in which false confessions were elicited and false testimony were allegedly elicited. So, you know, not everyone is blameless, but the vast majority of people, I think, try to do the right thing. One of the things that I think needs addressing in this country, and there's a lot of people who don't agree with this, is that while I believe most prosecutors are trying to do the right thing, I also think there's a mentality of winning over the sacrosanct search for the truth, and prosecutors operate in this country under a doctrine of immunity. There can be no kind of civil liability for false convictions or or wrongful acts that lead to a prosecution, like withholding of evidence or things like that. And I think that's an issue that needs to be seriously addressed. I think if prosecutors didn't operate under just a blanket of immunity, I think in some instances they might think twice. I live in Westchester County, New York, and one of the cases we profile is the case of Jeffrey Deskovic, who was exonerated after 16 years. He begged for DNA testing that would exonerate him. The district attorney of Westchester County for years would not test that DNA. She finally went off to run for office, and a new Westchester County DA came in. And after years of this poor guy being in prison, the new Westchester County DA agreed to the DNA testing, which not only exonerated Jeffrey Deskovic, but it also affirmatively pointed to the killer, who was sitting in prison for another crime, admitted that he did this killing. Hmm. And in those intervening years where the Westchester County DA, Janine Pirro, refused to test the DNA, somebody else was murdered. You know, so somebody was murdered because a district attorney refused to, she may have all the legal reasons behind her and all the protections, you know, that you can have, but the fact is that you find, especially in post-conviction cases where there is arguments for DNA testing and other sorts of post-conviction relief, prosecutors often dig their heels in and do not allow testing. And that, I mean, that's what happened in the West Memphis 3 case, and it took years for DNA testing to happen. And so, mistakes happen, but when prosecutors and justice system dig in and don't allow testing to exonerate people or look into claims of innocence, that I don't understand and needs to change. It takes far too long to undo a wrongful conviction. You know, people spend decades in prison.
All right, so let's talk about the case that you feature in the eyewitness identification episode that airs Sunday night. Prominently features a Dallas man named Christopher Scott, who was arrested in 1997. Tell us about him and tell us about the crime that he was accused of.
Well, Christopher Scott was wrongly convicted for murdering a crack cocaine dealer in 1997. After the murder, police saw Scott and another man driving near the scene of the murder, and he roughly matched the description given by the witness. Scott was arrested and brought to the station a few hours later. The dealer's live-in girlfriend was brought in by the police to ID Scott in person in what's called a show-up procedure, and Scott spent 13 years behind bars before the actual shooter confessed on his deathbed, and it was just, you know, certain techniques were used so that it was just a completely faulty witness identification. And this guy spent 13 years in prison before, you know, he was exonerated, all based, I mean, there was no other evidence but a faulty eyewitness identification.
So no fingerprints, no hair, no blood, nothing other than this identification to peg Scott to the crime.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And in that case, we also profile a case in New Orleans. A guy named George Toka was arrested and convicted of murdering his best friend, Eric Batiste, and during the course of a botched armed robbery in 1985. Again, no physical evidence tying Toka to the scene, you know, but two eyewitnesses, both of them white, picked Toka out of this what's called a six-pack photo lineup, you know, a practice that has now been discredited. And Toka actually still remains in prison, and he still is looking for relief. And that's where you see these faulty eyewitness identifications happen the most in cross-racial identifications. You know, when a white person is identifying a black person, you see mistakes happen the most. And, you know, police sometimes contribute to, you know, the appropriate way to do a eyewitness identification is to tell the person in advance that one of the six people in this photo lineup or real lineup, you know, that the person who committed the crime may not necessarily be in the lineup. Hmm. But police often neglect to do that, and so people feel a pressure to pick somebody. And there are certain gestures and certain ways of communicating to somebody to get them to do, You know, because people want to please. They want to give an answer. And so if you don't tell them right up front, well, it's not necessarily any of these people. And so that's just one technique. Another technique is, you know, it should be standard that the person administering the test should have no knowledge of the crime, so that even subtly, even unwittingly, they're not pointing the person in the right direction. You know, something as simple as, you know, somebody picks somebody out, and then the test administrator says, because the person might say, well, I think it's that person, and then the test administrator says, well, that's the person we think it is, and then, of course, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So, you know, there's a whole science to how these tests should be administered, and, you know, a huge percentage of these tests go awry.
So people have seen on television shows these lineups, and I wonder how those, you know, six or eight guys standing in front of the ruler markers, how those actually compare with the way it's typically done in a lot of police stations around the country.
Well, you know, I think, you know, I can't, you know, I'm not a big watcher of television, even though I make television, so I can't really compare it to a particular show, but, you know, the people taking the tests need to have no knowledge of the crime, and that you often don't see that on television.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the people administering the test should have no knowledge of the crime, so that they can't even unwittingly suggest something that might make that might skew the results, and often the tests are done photographically and not in person, and that also has generated false results.
Well, you mentioned this thing called the six-pack lineup. Explain for us what that is.
Yeah, it's they take a photograph of literally six different suspects who tend to look similar, and sometimes these photographs are, you know, not even actual photos. They're Xeroxes, and they're presented with six options at once. And, you know, under certain circumstances, people can be pressured into picking, you know, the wrong suspect.
You show a couple of really interesting sort of experiments in this documentary, one of which you took part in, and that is you were shown a series of line drawings of what looks like the Lincoln head side of the penny.
Right.
Tell us what happened.
Well, you know, in fact, this is the test to demonstrate that without telling the person that one of the candidates might not actually be the suspect, this was just a little psychological test that the expert in the show demonstrated to us, which was I was shown, you know, a number of images of the penny, the U.S. penny, and some of them you could immediately reject because they didn't look like a penny. You know, you could tell immediately, and some were very similar to what your memory of a penny could be. And I zeroed in on one penny, and then, in fact, I changed my mind because she asked me, are you sure that's the one you like? Which I felt was maybe I had made the wrong choice, so I zeroed in on another penny. And in fact, none of the pennies in the picture were the correct representation of what an actual U.S. penny looks like. And yet I was convinced that I had picked out the right one, and I had been moved along the spectrum by, you know, a quote-unquote innocent suggestion confirming whether or not I believed that particular penny. So what she should have told me at the outset, just like when you're confronted with a series of suspects, what I should have been told was that none of these pennies might actually be the proper representation of a U.S. penny.
My guest is filmmaker Joe Berlinger. We're talking about his series, The System, with Joe Berlinger. We'll be back to the conversation in just a minute.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with filmmaker Joe Berlinger. His documentary Eyewitness Identification airs June 8th on Al Jazeera America as an episode of the series The System with Joe Berlinger. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Let's go to the phones now and speak with Carlos in Dallas. Hello, Carlos.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Great, thank you.
My question is once a person is wrongfully accused of a crime and they've been in jail, like you said, for, 16 years, and they didn't do it and they got out, is there any kind of financial compensation they get? And what happens to the prosecutor that wrongfully convicted them? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call. Joe, what can you tell us about that?
That's a great question, and before I answer it, I do want to make clear in this episode, because I did talk about, you know, when prosecutors do bad things, I do want to say that Dallas District Attorney Craig Watkins, who we feature in the show, actually is responsible for exonerating Christopher Scott and did an amazing job and, in fact, established the first conviction integrity unit in the country, and now other districts are starting to do these conviction integrity units, which I think is very important to review cases. And so, you know, Craig Watkins, deserves, you know, a lot of praise for that. So I just want to be clear about that. You know, the rule of thumb, if you're wrongfully convicted and you get out, is that, you know, people should be awarded, you know, $1 million a year. That's kind of for every year of wrongful conviction. Sometimes that happens, sometimes that doesn't. You know, sometimes it's settled, sometimes there are lawsuits. But, you know, what was so devastating in the West Memphis 3 case, which is the subject of the Paradise Lost films, is Arkansas, despite overwhelming evidence that these guys, that the West Memphis 3 were innocent, Arkansas, in a very cowardly way, you know, they vacated the death penalty for Damien Echols, which was, of course, excellent that he got off of death row, and vacated the 2 life without parole sentences for his colleagues. But they did this kind of twisted thing where they made them plead to what's called an Alford plea, and that is where you maintain your innocence, but you declare your guilt for legal purposes just to get out from the weight of being on death row or in prison. And so you stand before the court and say the state has enough evidence to convict me even though I am innocent. And so these 3 guys, after 18 years of wrongful conviction, I mean, these guys were 16, 17, and 18 years old, respectively, when they went into prison. So their whole, you know, youth and early adulthood was robbed from them. But they left prison as convicted killers, even though everyone who supports them believes that they're innocent. And, in fact, the state of Arkansas knows that they're innocent because they were convicted of the brutal, devil-worshipping murder of 3 8-year-old children. And does anyone really believe that the state of Arkansas, if it had a deep and abiding belief that, you know, devil-worshipping child murderers, you know, actually did the crime, would they really remove the death penalty, and life without parole? So they clearly knew these guys were innocent, and the overwhelming amount of evidence that showed that they were innocent was compelling to everybody, but they didn't want to pay the $1 million a year, is my guess. And, you know, because 18 years times 3 defendants is $54 million. But generally speaking, you know, there is some monetary compensation. But I have spoken with so many people who have gotten out of prison, and the money is nice when it happens, and it doesn't happen every time. But, you know, these people have had their lives robbed from them. And, you know, no amount of money can replace that lost time because it just takes so long to get out of prison. With regard to prosecutorial or police being reprimanded when that happens, it almost never happens. Again, as I was saying at the outset, you know, there's a thing called prosecutorial immunity, and prosecutors, generally speaking, are immune from any kind of actions. You know, once in a while, there's a guy named Claude Stewart in a New York case who was removed and reprimanded because, you know, some of his tactics, which we profile in an episode on prosecutorial misconduct or prosecutorial integrity. But the unbelievable thing is the guy who he was responsible for putting away a guy named Tyrone Johnson, who still sits in Sing Sing prison after going through a second trial. I mean, here you have a prosecutor who was removed from office under a cloud, and yet the person he was responsible for putting away, again, with a, even though it wasn't in the eyewitness identification episode, again, no physical evidence, just a faulty eyewitness identification and no other real evidence. I have tremendous respect for prosecutors. It's not a well-paying job, and it's a hard job, and I think, generally speaking, the DA tries to do what's right. But when things go wrong, terribly wrong, and when attempts to exonerate are rebuffed post-conviction, you know, I think there needs to be some level of accountability.
We actually had Damien Eccles on the show when his book came out, and he told such a fascinating story. And I have to tell you, the thing that still strikes me, to the extent that many people now believe the West Memphis Three were not guilty of that crime, is the fact that whoever did the crime has not been searched for all
right.
these years.
Right. That's the other. That's a great point. You know, the prosecutor in Arkansas stood before the press on the day that Eccles and company were released and said that he has no reason to believe that the people who, in a word play, you know, these guys were forced to plead guilty, technically plead guilty, just to get out of prison. And so in a game of words, this prosecutor stood before the assembled press and said, you know, he has no reason to believe that the people who pled guilty today, you know, are the ones who are guilty of the crime, and so we're not going to go look for the killers, you know, which is just perverse because it means the real killers haven't been found. Or in the case that I cited before in Westchester County, we know that the refusal to test DNA led to the murder of a school teacher, because nobody took action on these false conviction claims that Deskovic mounted for a long time.
So people may be listening to this, Joe, and thinking, well, I guess, false witness identifications can happen, but I would never do that. If I were affected by a crime, I would remember. You have a really remarkable experiment in this documentary wherein a group of college students is asked to ID a man who allegedly steals a laptop computer. Tell us about the setup and what the experiment showed.
Yeah, some students at John Jay Criminal Law School were brought in for an experiment. They weren't told what the experiment was, but they were participating in an experiment involving the criminal justice system, and they were brought in and seated, and the test administrator came in and started introducing them to the test, and then she said she realized she forgot the consent forms, and she said she'll be right back. She walked out of the room to go get the consent forms, and people had no reason to believe that actually the test was happening. This was the test. And a colleague purportedly came in and said he was here to get the administrator's laptop computer. And, of course, the students didn't know what he was talking about, but this guy took the computer and walked out. The teacher came back in with the consent, or the administrator of the test came back in with the consent forms to allegedly start the test, and then was alarmed and said, hey, where's my computer? And the students explained, well, that this guy had come to fix the computer and thought it would be okay if he took it. And she started freaking out, saying, oh, no, that's my computer's been stolen. And then they said, that is the test, you know, that she let people in on it and said, okay, this is the test. The guy who took the computer shouldn't have, but that was the test. And so now we want you to identify the guy who stole the computer.
Mm-hmm.
And they did six-pack photo lineups, and in the photo was not... None of the choices were the guy who actually perpetrated the stealing of the computer, and yet people were convinced, you know, several different people were chosen by each of the students with utter conviction that that was the guy who did it. And so the vast majority of the witness identifications were wrong with people. And these weren't even cross-racial identifications where most of the mistakes actually happened. So it just demonstrates that even when people who have the best intentions don't remember, you know, crimes happen, especially violent crimes, happen in a moment's notice. And, you know, eyewitness identifications without any other corroborating evidence are often wrong.
You know, I mean, I sort of saw this coming when I was watching the episode, and I thought, okay, this is probably the thing. And I tried to pay attention to this guy. He's like just a kind of, you know, average-looking middle-aged white guy who comes in and takes the computer. And then I saw the six-pack lineup, and I did exactly what you have talked about, which is that I sort of looked for the person who I thought most resembled this individual and didn't consider initially that maybe he wasn't even on the form.
Exactly.
Yeah. And again, this is a great example of people who weren't trying to lie. These students hadn't lost their computer. They had no particular motivation to finger the wrong person, and yet they did it anyway.
Exactly.
Hmm. All right, so talk about like the unit that was set up in Dallas County that is reinvestigating what may be wrongful convictions. How expensive is a unit like that, and what kind of resources does it take to do it properly?
Well, you know, you'd have to ask those folks how expensive it is. To me, it's like, how can you not?
Mm-hmm.
And we have a handful of these around the country. Charles Hines, the former Brooklyn DA, set one up after accusations of his office having a lot of botched investigations. Sometimes it's done for political cover, as I think the Brooklyn one was, and sometimes it's done for the right reasons, as I think the one in Dallas was set up for all the right reasons. The resources, everything costs money, but when you're talking about innocent people going to prison and killers walking the streets, there should be no expense spared. And more importantly, than a killer walking free, but equally relevant to the financial conversation, is that a lot of these wrongful conviction cases end up in multimillion-dollar lawsuits. I mean, Jeffrey Deskovic, again, another case we highlight, walked away with, well over $12 million in settlements from various entities. So what is the cost of, you know, settling with wrongful convictions? What is the moral cost of prosecutions that don't have integrity versus, you know, setting up these units to investigate these things?
How do prosecutors make decisions about how much evidence is enough evidence to use to bring someone before a grand jury, for example?
That is a good question I can't answer, because I've seen some cases that just kind of boggle my mind that they've been brought in front of a grand jury, you know. I think it's a scale that, you know, is different for every prosecutor, but that's hard for me to answer.
Do police departments and prosecutors in particular jurisdictions tend to differ on the methods that they want used to identify witnesses?
Well, there have been tremendous disparities, and that's why there's now a science of eyewitness identification, and there's been a whole set of guidelines published. Some police departments are following them, some aren't. And that's something that I think the show is trying to stress, that there is a science of how to run identifications. I urge all police departments to really, you know, follow these guidelines.
And it's not an easy thing once someone has been, I'm not just accused, but convicted. Even if everything then goes in the right direction to untangle this and get innocent people freed, sometimes it can take years, even after they find someone who's willing to review their case.
It's just, don't get convicted of something you didn't do, because it is a legal nightmare beyond all proportion. And again, that is, you know, unfortunately, I think there is an attitude, especially when the prosecutor's office is an elected office. And so when people are running for re-election, they need to have wins. And again, I'm not castigating every prosecutor. I'm not saying this is the motivation of every prosecutor. But I think there's an inherent conflict of interest when a prosecutor is elected based on his conviction record, based on his stance on crime. And I think that skews the results. It should not be about winning at all costs. The prosecutor should be, you know, interested in the sacrosanct pursuit of the truth, even if it goes against winning. And unfortunately, we don't see that happening in every case.
I'd like to go back and talk a little bit more about what you learned about false confessions, because so many people imagine that if they didn't do a crime, nothing could compel them to admit to having done something. Can you talk about what you learned about how this does, in fact, happen?
Yeah, I mean, false confessions, again, now, most cases don't involve DNA, and those are the tough ones, you know, but I think with DNA exonerations, and there have been, you know, over 320 DNA exonerations to date, a huge number of those involve false confessions as well. So, and if it wasn't for the DNA component to it, we would never have known about the false confession being the trigger for the conviction. So, you know, it is believed by experts that there is a huge number of false conviction cases based on false confessions that have yet to see the light of day in terms of people getting a chance to appeal these decisions in a meaningful way. And again, as I said earlier, it is counterintuitive to think you would confess to something you didn't do. But often these are cases in which people have sometimes limited intelligence, frankly, or they're young and they're in a pressure-filled situation. As we saw with Jesse Miskelly in the West Memphis 3 case, you're surrounded by police. You don't have a parent or a lawyer present.
Let me jump in. We have to take a quick break. My guest is filmmaker Joe Berlinger. We're talking about Eyewitness Identification, his documentary that airs Sunday as part of the series The System with Joe Berlinger. We'll be back in just a minute.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with filmmaker Joe Berlinger. Eyewitness Identification, his documentary, airs June 8th on Al Jazeera America as an episode of The System with Joe Berlinger. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Joe, you were talking about Jesse Miskelly, who did make a false confession, or many people believe it was a false confession now. No lawyer present, no parent present, high pressure situation.
And so you're under this pressure. You're the hours wear on. You're tired. You're scared. And the reaction is, well, I'll just say what I need to say to get out of this current situation, and I'll fix it later. That's the most common thing. I'll say what I need to say, and we'll fix it later. You know, Jeffrey Deskovic, again, another case we profile, which was based on a false confession, and then later DNA exonerated him. He was taken from one county to the other. He was hooked up to a lie detector test, told it was a regular administrator, but in fact it was somebody from another police department, and they good copped, bad copped it, with one cop acting like his friend, another cop. And, you know, sometimes these interrogation techniques are valid to root out, a real criminal, you know. But when you have a teenager without a lawyer present, without a parent present, it becomes a very difficult thing. And so he just, you know, he was exhausted and just said what the police wanted to hear. He thought the police wanted to hear so he could just get out of the room and figured he'd fix it later. I mean, that is the most common thing we see in false confessions.
We should say that in a couple of weeks, you have an episode dealing with the juvenile justice system, which has been a concern for people for many years, but it seems is getting a great deal of attention these days.
Yeah, we have over 2,000 juvenile life without paroles, juvenile lifers in our system. And these are people who, you know, admittedly sometimes do terrible things as 13, 14, 15-year-olds. But the question is, and I don't necessarily have the answer, and I should say a lot of these questions that we explore in the series, we don't try to just hit it from a one-sided point of view. We like to show both sides and, you know, create a debate. But, you know, the Supreme Court recently declared that a juvenile life without parole sentence is cruel and unusual punishment, and it should be deployed only in the most extremely rare cases and only after the judge reviews all the mitigating circumstances. And generally, that the hope was that it would lead to a decrease in juvenile life without parole sentences. Some states have interpreted the Supreme Court decision their own way, and they use, as we highlight in Michigan, which has the second highest number of juvenile lifers, in some cases a particular judge used the Supreme Court ruling that he had to review mitigating circumstances as a reason to affirm the life without parole sentence for juveniles. And then the other big unresolved issue is the issue of retroactivity. Going forward, the message of the Supreme Court is that this is rare, should be used rarely, and after a thorough process of investigating and having a hearing about mitigating circumstances that led to the crime. But it left it to the states to decide what to do about the cases that had already been decided prior to the Supreme Court's decision. And so there are a lot of people, you know, sitting, life without parole sentenced as juveniles whose fates are yet to be determined. And again, some of these crimes that we looked into are terrible crimes. Shooting a pizza delivery man, you know, calling up a pizza delivery man and having him deliver the pizzas and shooting him dead is one case we profiled. You know, it's not like we're saying juvenile lifers should, you know, go to reform school. But the idea that someone at 13, 14 years old is considered by society completely irredeemable and therefore never deserves another chance, you know, when the brain circuitry of a teenager is not fully developed, again, not to condone the crime, but we've seen, you know, many instances where people have, you know, rehabilitated themselves and have become productive members of society. So the juvenile life without parole issue is a tough one. And as I said, there's over 2,000 of them in our system.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Shannon in Arlington. Hi, Shannon.
Hi, thank you very much. A very frightening show. My question is, what can the public do to take away or at least to influence this power of immunity exercised by the prosecutors? There is a power machine. These are the power machine that, yes, they claim that they're tough against the crimes, but again, the same power machine can actually make the mockery out of the judicial system.
Excellent question. I mean, I think one of the goals of this series is just to raise awareness of these issues, and I think a lot of prosecutors are elected officials, and I think we need transparency, and we need more conviction integrity units, and I think people need to be aware of just, I mean, I think it would blow people's minds, as it did mine, doing this series, just how many claims of wrongful convictions there are, and I think it, you know, it's really alarming. I mean, look, America has 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's prison population. There's something wrong with that. You know, we are a country where we were founded on the belief
on the sanctity of our personal liberty. That is a founding principle of America, that there's nothing more sacred than our personal liberty. And the prosecutor and the justice system has a unique power to take that away. Now, of course, some people deserve to have it be taken away. I'm not disputing that, and often the justice system works. But we have seen the prison population grow by 700% in the last two decades. We've seen a failed war on drugs stuff the prisons with people on drug sentences that shouldn't necessarily be having long prison sentences. You know, we have more prisoners than Russia and China combined. That should tell us something. And the, you know, we just need to be aware. I think every American, it's why I did this series, I think every American needs to engage with the criminal justice system. And the other thing that is just, you know, tremendously heartbreaking is the extreme racial bias that's within the system. You know, statistically, one in three African-American men can expect to go to prison in their lifetime. Now, is that because one in three African-American men deserve to go to prison and are bad? Of course not. It's the system is skewed, and there are certain policies in place that prey upon minority and the lower socioeconomic rung of society can't fight certain policies, you know. And so I just think people should be aware of these things and speak out, and, you know, knowledge is power.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Harold on the line in Denton. Hi, Harold.
Hi. Very good show. Very relevant stuff. And I commend the guest on his work. A couple relevant facts. For folks in Dallas, in addition to establishing the Conviction Integrity Unit, Dallas's district attorney informed his prosecution staff a couple of years back that they would no longer pursue cases based solely on eyewitness testimony. There had to be physical evidence involved. I think that's a very good policy. In Texas, of the almost 80 death row convictions overturned by DNA, about 74% of those convictions were based on eyewitness testimony primarily. So these are some things that support the importance of what your guest has to say. So thank you. Great show. Good work.
Great statistics. In fact, I did not know that the prosecution, the DA's office is not, you know, pursuing cases with just an eyewitness identification. I think that's an outstanding policy that should be emulated elsewhere in the country.
Should eyewitness identifications, and I suppose there's also the question of, you know, if it's a stranger versus someone that is familiar to the person. Like, there may be times when eyewitness identification would be adequate to identify someone.
Yeah, but that's also complex because, you know, again, we have a case that we profile where Tyrone Johnson is sitting in Sing Sing prison. It's based exclusively on the dying declaration of the murder victim who collapsed on in front of his elderly mother and said, well, according to the police, he said to and to the mother, admittedly, which was a problem in the crime, said, you know, the mother said, Tyrone did it. Where Tyrone, who's a friend of the murder victim, claims that the dying declaration was Tyrone knows who did it because Tyrone was involved in mediating a dispute that had happened a week earlier. And there is no other evidence in this case. And there is overwhelming evidence to show that he didn't do the crime. So there could be circumstances, you know, where an eyewitness identification, family member, friend is rock solid, but I agree with your caller that, you know, there needs to be other evidence besides eyewitness identification.
How has Christopher Scott, your Dallas case, now exonerated, tried to rebuild his life?
Oh, his story is amazing. You know, he's opened up, you know, a store in Dallas. I think it's called Christopher's, or he's going to kill me because I'm forgetting the name of his store.
I wrote it in my notes. Let me see while you talk if I can find it here.
Yeah, so you know, I believe he got a settlement, and with that money, he's, you know, he's opened up this the store, Christopher's Menswear or something like that. I apologize, Christopher Scott. We should know the name of your store. We shot in it, but more importantly, he has you know, he's started. You know, he runs with other exonerees this thing called the House of Renewed Hope, and is trying to help other wrongfully convicted people. And you know, they've lobbied Texas legislators for more compensation for exonerees and more public services such as access to health care. And the House of Renewed Hope, which is again he runs with fellow exonerees, investigate other cases of wrongfully convicted individuals. You know, so that's what I find so fascinating, and find almost to the, you know, the vast majority of people who undergo this. I mean, nothing could be worse than to sit in prison for a day for something you didn't do. Could you imagine? Let alone, you know, decades. And to a person, you know, I found it with the West Memphis Three, Jason Baldwin in particular, who I've become very close with. You know, they Jeffrey Deskovic, Christopher Scott. They get out of prison, and they're not, you know, riddled with bitterness and anger, as one might think, as I think I might be, you know. You know, I think that they learn early on that anger will destroy them and get the better of them. So they come out of prison actually quite spiritually strong people, you know, who want to channel that negative experience into helping others in the same boat. You know, Jeffrey Deskovic, you know, got a multi-million-dollar settlement from various New York and state and county entities involved in his wrongful conviction. And like Christopher Scott, he started a foundation, the Jeffrey Deskovic Foundation. And he focuses on, well, he will look at DNA cases, but he has a specialty in looking at non-DNA cases, because that, you know, I think the beauty of DNA technology in the last decade has, you know, not only has it led to exoneration, but I think it's you know, sensitized the American public to those who want to pay attention that wrongful convictions, you know, can happen. I think before the advent of technology, you know, DNA technology, I think much more people would have a hard time believing that the justice system doesn't make mistakes. You know, and I think we've seen so many people become exonerated through DNA technology that I think the regular person who pays attention to the legal system understands that mistakes happen. But the problem is most cases don't involve DNA, or there's no recoverable DNA. And so what about all the other false convictions? And so Jeffrey Deskovic, you know, his foundation looks at non-DNA cases.
So gotta jump in here. We're out of time. Filmmaker Joe Berlinger is host of the documentary series The System on Al Jazeera America. The episode Eyewitness Identification airs June 8th. Joe, really fascinating. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me. Take care.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Christina Ulsh. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.